You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, February 1st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we're going to try this again with an internet provider. Okfo Sho will be joining us from Oakland. The live streamer of Occupy Oakland extraordinaire later in the program. Hopefully, if the judge lets him out of the courtroom in time, we'll be talking to Jeff Smith, media team at Occupy Wall Street, and more. The Republicans voted in Florida yesterday. Mitt Romney... he spent something like $12 to $14 million, and he got his money worth. He won fairly big last night. We will dig into that as the show progresses. And Mitt Romney saying poor people are fine, which may explain why the Susan Komen breast care charity, cancer fighting charity, has cut off all funding to Planned Parenthood, which gives poor women breast care exams. It is stunningly reprehensible, but that's what happens when a charity gets taken over by the right-wingers. You remember now, right? This is why we don't need things like Medicare or Medicaid, because charities will take care of this. Unless, of course, they hire right-wingers who don't care about poor women getting breast cancer. Let's face it, folks. Poor women just simply make a bad choice when they decide to get breast cancer. We will talk about that as we go further in the program. But first, the champion of the Republican Party now, and like I said today on CNN, I don't think this race is over until Newt Gingrich decides he has no more books to sell. So he could be with us for quite a while. But Mitt Romney, talking about his victory on CNN today, had this to say. If you have any question as to whether or not he is pivoting to the general election, or I don't even know how to explain what he's thinking here. Yes, I do. Let's play it.
By the way, I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there.
Stop.
If it needs repair, I'll fix it.
You understand, folks, that the poor, they're not Americans. All the poor in this country are Europeans. We know that. He's not concerned about the poor. Why should he be? Because they're doing great. I mean, except for the poor part. But they're great. Are you kidding? We take so much tax money from people, Americans, real Americans, and give it to the poor that they're driving around in Bentleys. They're living it up. Dude, they take that $200 of food stamps they get, and it's party time. Go back to the beginning so people can hear this and just let it sink in. And then he realizes, I think by the end of the interview, he said the wrong thing because he changes what he says at the end. Go ahead.
By the way, I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine. I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90, 95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
All right. I know I said last question, but I got to ask you. You just said, I'm not concerned about the very poor because they have a safety net. And I think there are lots of very poor Americans who are struggling who would say, that sounds odd. Can you explain that?
Well, you had to finish the sentence, Soledad. I said, I'm not concerned about the very poor that have a safety net, but if it has holes in it, I will repair them.
Got it. Okay.
The challenge right now, we will hear from the Democrat Party the plight of the poor.
Oh!
And there's no question, it's not good being poor, and we have a safety net to help those that are very poor. But my campaign is focused on middle-income Americans. My campaign, you can choose where to focus. You can focus on the rich. That's not my focus. You can focus on the very poor. That's not my focus. My focus is on middle-income Americans, retirees living on Social Security, people who can't find work, folks that have kids that are getting ready to go to college.
Okay, we don't need to hear
any more of this.
The retirees who are living on, if they're lucky, I guess $16,000 a year, they're hurt. The very poor, though, they're fine. In fact, they're not just fine. They're taking advantage of the real heart of America. And that's not what I said, Soledad. I said they have a safety net.
I wonder if that something dropping you heard was like Mitt Romney's campaign manager's jaw hitting the floor.
I think that was people at CNN going, God, man, what is with this dude? So there you have it. Mitt Romney. Yeah, people can focus on it's not my focus. I'm not concerned with the poor. Of course he's not, because he's running still in the Republican primary. And in the Republican primary, you have to demonize the poor, because you need that resentment from the middle. From the middle class, you want to draw. And you know who's screwing you, don't you, middle class? The poor. And we know who all they are. They're not Americans. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Okfo Show. The small caveat that the internet may go out at any moment. We have no show at all. We'll be right back after this.
Every day I get up and pray to John. And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Spencer Mills, you may know him by his nom de live stream, I guess. Okfo Show. He's at Okfo Show on Twitter. Welcome to the program, Spencer.
Thank you for having me.
I spent, I guess it was Saturday night now, watching your webcast, which was picked up by a lot of different outlets. You had the best view of the nearly, I guess, 400 people who were arrested. Tell me what happened on Saturday in Oakland.
Well, the weekend, in fact, was billed as kind of a move-in day, rise-up festival. And Saturday, Occupy Oakland had plans on basically taking an abandoned space, an empty foreclosed space or an abandoned space, an unused space, and turning it into a community center, an organizing space, a place for a library and health services, things like that, for free for the community, the homeless population, etc. And OPD, I assume, got wind of the first location, the Kaiser Convention Center, that folks wanted to go to. OPD surrounded that building and did not allow the march to approach it, at which point in time there was some clashes around that building where tear gas was used, and the march moved off. As the day continued, at a place called 10th and Oak in Oakland, there were more clashes. In fact, probably the clashes people saw on the internet or on their news. It was the largest clash of the day. Protesters with shields basically lined off of OPD lines, and a lot of flashbangs, tear gas, rubber bullets, bean bags, smoke bombs, etc., used there. The day kind of went on. That march ended as OPD kind of pushed it back towards downtown. Folks regathered downtown, and a second march was started towards a second building. That march eventually turned into a impromptu FTP march. I don't know if your viewers understand what that is, but it's basically a march against police brutality in Oakland as a result of what has happened to Occupy Oakland and the treatment that it's received from OPD over its existence. That march was eventually kettled at a place called 19th and Telegraph. It's a public park. OPD basically hemmed in the march, kettled it, and started using tear gas on it with not letting anybody leave, even though they were giving dispersal. They apparently gave a dispersal order.
Now, wait a second. Let's just for people to understand, when you say kettle, you're talking about using those orange kettling nets, basically blockading the area off. So they have now trapped the protesters, supposedly gave a dispersal notice, and then made it impossible for them to disperse as they're putting tear gas into the area that they've entrapped them in.
Well, basically what they were doing, there were no nets. It was just basically, police lined up shoulder to shoulder at intersections, blocking off a large public park.
Okay.
One of the walls, I guess, that was used to hem in protesters was, a chain link fence. And once OPD started using tear gas, people, ripped down that fence to escape, because OPD was not providing an outlet to essentially leave. As a result, that fence was kind of torn down, and people ran back out to Telegraph and continued the march. Eventually, the march was kettled again in front of the YMCA, which is what people saw from my video up on the third floor from somebody's apartment. And that march was kettled, and about 400 people were there. Some made it out through the YMCA. Others hopped the fence, but about 400 people didn't escape, and they were all arrested or detained, including, I believe, about six journalists, most of whom were, all of whom were eventually released within a reasonable time, I believe. But nevertheless, about six journalists were detained as well. And that's pretty much what happened.
So there was no attempt to occupy the YMCA. It was just basically an escape route, people trying to get away from tear gas, or simply just trying to get away from the being trapped by the police?
Well, it was just trying to get away from being trapped by the police, because, of course, people, OPD, has a history of not being very nice. And as OPD kind of closed in on the march and rushed in, people ran up the stairs of the YMCA, begged the YMCA to open their doors. Eventually, somebody from inside the YMCA did open their doors. A couple hundred people got inside. About apparently about 100 or 150 escaped to the back before OPD closed off that exit. And apparently some of the folks that were inside the caught inside the YMCA are now being charged with burglary. But I'm actually not terribly sure how many, if not all, of those people are being charged with burglary. But you know, I mean, I don't know how those charges are going to stick in court, but.
Now, what of the reports of people who went into the Oakland City Hall?
So again, I wasn't there for that. The initial reports were that people broke into City Hall. Apparently, the doors were open, and some people went inside. There was some vandalism that took place inside. Apparently, it was a very small group of people, around 10 to 20 people. But I wasn't around for that, and so I can't really speak very to the accuracy of what has been reported. What I have heard is that the doors were open and there were some things vandalized.
Now, 400 people were arrested, and how many people were actually involved in the marches in total? Would you say?
At the height of the day, I'd say a couple thousand.
And so give me a sense of now, do you know anything that what's the disposition of those 400 people? Were they processed and released in a timely fashion? You know, in the past, we've heard some pretty bad stories.
Well, a lot of people were released within a lot of people were taken to Glendire. Some people were a lot of people were taken to Santa Rita. It's my understanding, as of yesterday in the mid-afternoon, there were still about 40 to 50 people in Santa Rita, and I'm actually unsure right now as to how many people are left. Last I heard, you know, there were, mid-afternoon, midday yesterday, about 40 to 50 people still in custody. There's a kind of a jail support vigil outside Santa Rita of Occupy Oaklanders that are out there waiting for people to be released. There are stories coming out from within Santa Rita that some of which have been unconfirmed, but apparently there's been stories of mistreatment from within Santa Rita from Occupy Oaklanders basically not being allowed to use the restroom, those individuals that need medication not being provided that medication, some individuals receiving possible beatings from inside the jail, and then there's even worse unconfirmed stories. And I haven't personally been able to speak with anyone from within Santa Rita to confirm those, so I don't really want to get into those. But there's been some horror stories from within the jail. People basically sitting in their own urine and vomit, basically holding cells, holding three times the number of people that they're really supposed to hold. People sitting, with tear gas soaked clothing, zip ties for 7-8 hours that are on too tight, cutting off circulation. These are all, especially with regards to not being able to use the restroom, with regards to zip ties, with regards to medication, these are all stories we've heard before.
Right.
So it would be nothing new if this kind of mistreatment was taking place this time.
My understanding is that the mayor was seeking, trying to get some type of stay away orders, basically. And we heard this, I think, after the first raid on the encampments in Oakland. Where the police were saying, if you head back before your trial date, you're gonna sit in jail until your trial date. What do you know on that accord? I mean, what can the mayor say? Like, stay away from the entire city? How wide a net is the mayor looking to throw here?
So there's a few things going on. Before Saturday, there were two or three people that had been given stay away orders from Oscar Grant Plaza, also known as Frank O'Gallo Plaza, out front of City Hall. After Saturday, Some local media reported something like 12 more stayaways were issued for City Hall itself, and some have reported up to about 20 stayaways have been given. The exact number I'm actually not sure of. Basically, it's people, you're not allowed to go to City Hall if you have a stayaway from City Hall or a stayaway from Oscar Grant Plaza. If you show up, what apparently they've done to a couple people is, they've spotted them taking their photograph at Oscar Grant Plaza and later picked them up on a warrant for, failure to obey the stay away. That's what's happening to some people with regards to being charged and having stay away orders.
Who are they targeting for these stay away orders? I mean, is it random, or is the city attempting to keep who they perceive to be leaders away? I mean, how do they decide who's a stay away?
With regards to the latest stay aways, I don't know what their criteria is. The previous stay aways were individuals that were, if you don't want to call them, we don't really have leaders, but I would say that they were heavily involved occupiers. The people that received stay away orders prior to Saturday, it was about two or three. And those individuals are heavily involved in what Occupy Oakland is doing. I couldn't speak to exactly why they received stay away orders in the first place.
Now, Mayor Gene Kwan made a call to the leaders of the national Occupy movement, asking them essentially to denounce Occupy Oakland. My sense is that's unlikely, and I'm not even sure who she's asking for this denouncement. But give me a sense of what the feeling is in Oakland. In other words, there's been reports of polling that show, well, people are less sympathetic now with Occupy Oakland because of things like the vandalism in the city hall, despite the fact that it literally was 1% of the people involved in actions on Saturday. Just how sensitive is your sense that people at Occupy Oakland are to how the movement is being perceived? Is that even relevant? And do you have a sense? I mean, obviously, Oakland has a long history of direct action, of having more militant, maybe not the right word, but certainly more contentious protests. It was the site of the last wild general strike back in 47, 48. Just give me your sense of that.
So, I mean, to speak frankly with regards to Saturday, the movement itself is kind of losing the information war on this one. Mainstream media has reported, the movement in a sense is very much a public relations battle, and what some of the stories that have become kind of prevalent in mainstream media about Saturday, which are completely and totally false, are very prevalent among the public. I mean, I had people at City Hall last night tell me that an improvised explosive device was thrown at LPD at 10th and Oak. And for those of us that were there watching, that seems a little bit ridiculous. I personally never saw an improvised explosive device thrown at OPD. What I did see was individuals kick back tear gas canisters or kick back flashbangs back at OPD after they were tossed at them from the police lines. But that's one of the common misconceptions about Saturday. Another common misconception, of course, is that folks tried to occupy the Y. Another common misconception is, the march itself outside of the YMCA, there was an exchange there and that it was violent. And the truth is there was really no exchange of violence from protesters towards OPD outside the YMCA. Everybody was just pretty much kettled there and under arrest. There was some violence as far as people being hit with batons, including some reports of someone that was pregnant being hit in the kidneys with batons. There are reports of people just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time on the street, and OPD just kind of pushed them into the kettle. Just random people on the street that happened to see this march go by that just got swept up by an OPD kettle. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happened on Saturday that's being reported by mainstream media that's just that's not true, and then there's a lot of stuff that's not being reported by mainstream media that if it was, would kind of create, in my opinion, create sympathy. But, you know, I mean...
I love the use of using... the IEDs. You know, I love the use of saying these improvised explosive devices because we know where that term was coined. It was coined, you know, in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And so the idea is that, you know, the media and the city is trying to make it seem like this is a group of insurgent terrorists. Which, of course, is obviously not the case.
I mean, like De La Fuente, the council member, one of the main council members, you know, who's, you know, often involved at city council meetings and makes headlines, you know, went ahead and referred to the actions of Saturday as possible domestic terrorism. This is, you know, a city council member in Oakland. And, you know, I mean, it's my experience that Occupy Oakland wants to assist their community, wants to help the homeless. Well, you know, I mean, basically, and just one key statistic, while Occupy Oakland had a camp in Oakland, there was a 19% drop in crime in Oakland. That's almost one-fifth of the crime in a major U.S. city, you know, being dropped almost directly as a result of a camp being up, you know, based on social and economic justice. Now, that doesn't sound like domestic terrorism to me, but nevertheless, you know, I mean, that kind of word has been thrown around by people like De La Fuente.
How do you draw that connection to me between the drop in crime and the encampment?
Well, look, you know, at Occupy Oakland, you have a very at-risk population, a population that was, you know, drawn to this camp by whether it be free medical services, free food, the open arms of the community, you know, welcoming them in where elsewhere they've never really been welcome before. I mean, it was an amazing transformation that you saw in people. People would come in with the mindset of, hey, this camp here, maybe there's something I can take or whatnot. And then by the time they left, you know, they ended up being part of the movement itself. You know, I mean, we even had reports that OPD, when people would be released from the local Glendire jail, whether they be, you know, homeless or whether they have kind of a mental health issues or whatnot, they would release them and tell them to come to Occupy Oakland, thinking that those people in our community would create problems. Well, in fact, we welcomed them with open arms. The problem is when you attack an at-risk community, as OPD has on many, many different occasions, when you attack and harass an at-risk community, those individuals that are at risk within that community might not necessarily react in a very positive or nonviolent or appropriate way. I mean, you're kind of asking for trouble. And that is what's happened in some cases, you know. But Occupy Oakland itself welcomed these folks in with open arms, and in many cases, you saw a transformation that was amazing. I mean, it's amazing what happens when you try to build a community based on social and economic justice. And I mean, you had youth hanging out from all over the city, whether it be West Oakland or East Oakland, that would come down, they would hang out, they would get involved. You know, I mean, it was really something to be seen.
And now my understanding is that Occupy Oakland is planning a day of direct action in response to what happened this weekend. Oh, before we even get to that, one of the stats I saw the city released was that crime went up that day of Saturday, because there were so many police who were called to, I guess, protect the abandoned building, or to kettle protesters. And the only thing I could think of was that moment on your stream when you were like, wait, are those guys eating Chinese food? And there was another guy, there was policemen, they were having a Chinese food dinner on their car, and they were getting burrito deliveries during the time where supposedly crime was going up around the city that we would believe. And it's one of the beautiful, I just wanted to, you know, again, compliment your work, because, you know, that literally, when I saw that report that all the police were tied up, I immediately thought, like, I saw them having Chinese food on their car, like, you know, all gathered around eating.
Right.
Chinese
I mean, it was a veritable powwow of officers around, like, two or three different cruisers, just surrounding the cruisers, eating on the hoods, the trunks, you know. And one of the things that's funny is, like, if you don't really know which reporters to be believed. I mean, Chief Jordan was asked in a press conference, you know, with all this going on, with all these officers downtown, how are you patrolling the rest of the city? And he told them, it's easy, it's not a problem. You know, and then the city comes out and says, oh, well, the crime went up and we can't patrol the city. So, you know, who's to be believed? Personally, I think, you know, and they also called for, you know, they also called for backup from other, emergency backup from other agencies around the Bay Area. So, you know, it seems like that they're you know, misleading,
right,
one way or the other. It's either easy and they can do it because they've got all this help from around the Bay Area, or they're not able to do it. You know, I'm under the impression that they just want to release facts and statistics
early on,
would help their side.
It's a perception war, and they have a lot of the apparatus in which they can attempt to shape that perception. Now, let's get to February 6th. Occupy Oakland's planning a day of action, a direct action in response to what happened this weekend. What can you tell me about what you know may happen on that day?
It's my understanding that is one of the days where a ton of arraignments will take place from what happened on Saturday in the morning. And so what they're calling for on that day is everybody to show up at about 8 or 9 a.m. at Glenn Dyer and other places where arraignments are taking place. And then from those arraignments, everybody is being asked to rally downtown, I believe around noon or 1 o'clock. I'm sure the times will become more... you know, if you stick to OccupyOakland.org, I'm sure the times will become more concrete. Everybody will gather and listen to speakers talk about police brutality and injustice. And then there might be a march involved with that as well.
Well, folks, we'll put a link up to Okfo Show's stream. I can't thank you enough for the work you've been doing. It's kept me very informed over the past several months. And I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it today.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on. Appreciate you as well.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street, zooming across the country via the use of the internet, which is apparently still up. And we'll be right back with Jeff Smith.
And the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all it's worth? Reaching out, scared kind of perfection. Let's try and keep as much emotion out of this as possible. Let's try not to remember any names. We'll do it for a country, for a people, for more vision. United will make them remember our history, or how we like to be told. How we like to be told. And we rock because us against them. We found our own reasons to sing. And it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that. When people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends, hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands all of a sudden.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone from the Occupy Wall Street media team. Jeff Smith. You know his Twitter handle, Don't Be a Putz. Jeff, how's your morning going?
I was good. It was sort of the met at the alternate location of the Occupy Wall Street headquarters, known as Central Booking Courthouse, Manhattan Criminal Court. Had my first court date. Had my first court date since the arrest at the Winter Garden on December 12th. And so all 17 of us were in attendance to see the judge.
Now, I hope you shaved and showered and wore your best Sunday outfit as you attended there. I got to tell you, my daughter, Mila, who you met when we came down to Liberty Square some time ago, has been following your entire saga. And it's I got to tell you, though, honestly, I mean, part of what you're doing is, you know, you should know. I mean, I don't know how relevant it is to you, but in the context of my life, it's very relevant. It's been a great opportunity for me to explain to Mila, because, you know, when she met you, she really liked you and you were very friendly. And, you know, a 6-year-old's perception of people who get arrested, you know, they look like the Hamburglar, and they've got, you know, like a mask on their eyes, and they're running around with a striped shirt and a cape. And so we've been able to talk a lot, and she's been very interested in just, you know, why you got arrested, why people do this. And it's been it's really been exciting for me to be able to sort of explain to her that there are times where when you believe something, when you believe that there are laws that are wrong or that you have a right to express yourself, people who willingly get themselves arrested. And so, you know, for whatever that's worth, I just wanted to let you know that.
No, I think it's really interesting because I think it plays in very much to the whole theme of Occupy Wall Street in terms of, you know, the white-collar criminals that we're protesting against on Wall Street that perpetrated this fraud. And then you sort of consider that against the low-level crime and the criminal state that we have that's so punitive in so many ways. And then you mix together this idea that somehow just dissenting against those, you know, powerful criminals somehow makes you a criminal yourself. And so the idea that, you know, all criminals have done something wrong and that our justice system is about, you know, doling out punishments to those wrongdoers is really tossed on its head. And I think, you know, what you described with Mila is very similar to what I saw back in Union Square, the pepper spray, the first pepper spray incident. And I was standing across the street as these, you know, young girls were kettled and were being arrested. And the part of the scene that most people didn't hear about was there were just New Yorkers on the other side of the street just wandering down. And I saw a mother with her two young daughters, very similar in age to Mila. And they were visibly upset, crying, like, "Mommy, Mommy, what did those girls do? Why are the cops being so mean to them?" And there's definitely a sort of cognitive dissonance, I think, particularly for children, when they see, you know, people that don't seem like criminals being treated as such. And so I think it's important for everyone to realize that our criminal justice system, you know, has some flaws right now. And so to reassess everyone's role in it, I think it's definitely been informative for me to have to go through this process and do it in person.
Now, I want to ask you, there's a couple of things I want to ask you about, but I want to start with, you know, this, one of the, in terms of addressing that issue, the issue of these white-collar criminals who crashed our economy, who continue to engage in fraud on a level that, you know, as they say, you steal little, they give you the Twitter handle, Don't Be a Putz, and you go in and rain, you steal a lot, they make you king. These we have Eric Schneiderman signing on to this the administration's financial fraud unit. I'm curious, not just as your reaction to this, but is there, you know, does like the General Assembly, are there working groups? Is this a relevant topic in the context of Occupy, or is it simply something like, hey, it's a good sign, but this is, you know, we just go forward anyways?
Actually, there isn't really a lot of talk of it, and I wish we would get back to that to a certain degree. I mean, I see these things. It definitely, Obama is once again kind of paying lip service, it appears, if nothing actually happens, but when Eric Schneiderman's talking about, you know, he expects to see prosecutions in the next 6 to 8 months,
yeah,
I'm definitely looking at my calendar and saying, yeah, I definitely want to see something like that happen. And I think that, you know, Occupy Wall Street should definitely be paying attention to that. I think some of what has gone on in Oakland and really most of the story of just cop versus protester is really a story that most of the bankers, I think, prefer.
Right.
And anything to get the heat off of Wall Street is, in my opinion, you know, pushing back against the real strength of Occupy Wall Street, because there's nobody, even politicians, as unpopular as they are, nobody's as unpopular as bankers are still. And no politicians really want to put the heat on those guys. So I think when people only knew Occupy Wall Street, something about the banks, I like that, that's when we were probably the most popular we've ever been. And I think some of these other tactics have started to, you know, maybe marginalize the message to a certain degree. So I would like to see certainly us not only pay attention to those ongoing trials and the investigations that Schneiderman's heading up, but I want to see us put as much heat as possible on them to actually turn into some real cases.
And, you know, it's incumbent upon me to remind everyone that Schneiderman was asked, I think it was when he was on Chris Hayes' show, and Hayes asked him about, you know, if the president is legitimately interested in this. And Schneiderman made a point, like, this isn't about the president. This is about the uprising of people across the country over the past year. And Schneiderman made a point of saying there's a fundamental difference in the tone and the narrative and the sense out there than there was when I first took office, which was, of course, only 2 or 3 years ago, and that is the uprising of the people. Now, you know, I'm not surprised that Eric Schneiderman's not going on national television saying, like, you know, wearing a 99% shirt and, you know, an Occupy Wall Street sign. But that's about as close, I think, as someone in his position is going to come and could come to saying this is happening because of the pressure we're getting from Occupy Wall Street and the like.
No, I completely agree. And I think that, you know, it may appear as if they don't care about public sentiment in a lot of cases, but similar to when, you know, the whole kind of Medicare messaging turned into town halls where representatives would go and just get their hats handed to them over Medicare,
mm-hmm.
It feels like the same kind of popular pressure that's all of a sudden, you know, whether it's the prosecutors or the politicians or any of them have sort of picked up their head and realized, hey, you know, we're next if we don't do something. And so I'm hoping that it, you know, that's the whole power of these types of protests. People say, where's the legislation? What candidate are you about? And really, it's more about just creating a narrative that makes it uncomfortable for these guys to do anything but the right thing.
Now, I asked this question of Oak Faux Show because, you know, the after this weekend, there was a poll that came out that showed that, you know, in some ways, an Oak Faux Show, I think, sort of echoed this, that the Occupy Oakland right now is sort of losing a little bit of the media narrative, the perception war, because they're being perceived as being too militant. Is it your sense that some of that is going on in New York as well? Because we're getting there seems now, I can't quite tell, because again, you know, it's a question of how this is reported, but I'm seeing more about Black Bloc, which is sort of an anarchist subset of people who just seem to be militant for militant's sake. Is there more of that happening in New York? Is it simply that the media is highlighting that? Is this a concern within the context of people within the Occupy movement?
You know, people have talked about that. I think that it's always been a relatively small and marginalized type of group. You're just talking about what I would describe as just young males doing things that young males do. So, you know, the black bloc tactics of dressing all in black and sort of, you know, literally locking arms together and creating blocks that you sort of attack the police with, I've not seen anything like that, but I've seen more kids throwing bottles, and even some of the attacks that were directed towards Tim Pool seemed, frankly, kind of juvenile. And I think it speaks more just to a little bit of us losing our, you know, focus and message. Some of these marches just seem to be a little pointless and to be just end in kind of wilding or people deciding to head towards some abandoned building and try and climb into it, things like that. And I really think what happened in the park was something. I mean, the encampment itself had such a powerful messaging aspect to it that people would hear these things about crazy anarchists or, you know, all kinds of crazy wild kids, and they would come to the park and talk to people and realize, hey, that's not really anything like that. These are just people like me, and they're concerned about the same financial issues, and people love that conversation. And so I think, sadly, breaking up the encampments was a really effective tool that Bloomberg used, the strategy to try and hurt this movement. And right now I think we're trying to figure out a way to make it come back in that same kind of organic and productive realm. And right now I think we're kind of struggling with that a little bit.
So that is, I mean, that is something that's being discussed in the context of the General Assembly or, you know, working groups, this idea that, you know, we need a central focus because it helped in terms of, it helped show the public and the media what the movement was really about because it was more literally grounded.
Exactly, you know, and I think because we became such an irritant to the Wall Street people by literally being in their neighborhood and drawing other people, and, you know, that shame factor is such a powerful thing.
Right.
And by being able to clear us out and sort of put us in a space where no one can see us, it definitely removes that element of shame. And so it seems like Bloomberg decided to just kind of take the hit that his reputation would take by clearing out the camp, and he definitely caught a lot of it, but just decided in the long run it was probably still worth it.
Right.
And so, you know, I kind of think that's what we're seeing now. But I think come springtime, I mean, even as the weather goes up and down, you know, during the wintertime and we get these crazy warm days, you definitely see many more people hitting the streets. So it seems like a long way away, but when you start to think about the longer trajectory of some of these messages that we're talking about in politics, you realize, you know, it's not really about the next night's march or the next action as much as it is coming up with something that's really going to be big and powerful as a direct action coming for the spring. So I think you're going to start to see people really preparing and creating new organizations behind the scenes now. And I'm already starting to see that happen. So I wouldn't worry too much about the sort of black bloc element. The stuff that made Occupy Wall Street really work from the beginning did not really have any of those elements.
Right.
And so, and finally, you know, I think that...
Go ahead.
No, so, I mean, I think that you'll definitely see the people that were the strongest, you know, I wouldn't say leaders, but the people that were the most instrumental in making Occupy Wall Street what it was continue to come up with new and interesting things come springtime.
Now, you mentioned Tim Pool, and he is one of the live streamers who was part of the Other 99 Ustream, and then I guess there was a falling out. There's been a little bit within the context, and this is really getting into the weeds to a certain extent, so I don't want to spend too much time in here. But, I mean, there's been Twitter, and I've seen, like, a piece on The Gothamist and different places where there seems to be some dissension in terms of his role. Is this something that is a function of just like personality squabbles that have to do more with this period of time where Occupy Wall Street is still like sort of trying to not quite reinvent itself, but reorient itself? Or is it indicative of a change in perhaps the notion of transparency that Occupy has sort of pursued and maintained as one of its principles?
Well, I think a lot of what's happened with Tim Pool is just because of the notoriety he's received himself. And so he's become a little bit of a, you know, a media star, media darling within the movement. And I think some of the other live streamers and other citizen journalists may have felt, you know, insulted or, you know, in some ways like they deserve as much credit as Tim Pool. But by the same token, Tim Pool is always extremely coy when it comes to his involvement with the movement and his participation. And so, you know, I think in some ways he brings it on himself. And I definitely don't condone any of the personal attacks made on him in terms of, you know, grabbing him or, you know, any of these so-called black bloc types that have tried to smash his camera or things like that. But at the same token, if he wanted to, you know, dispel any of the notions that he's somehow, you know, when they call him a snitch, it's not really that he's actively trying to inform the police, but that he may be unwittingly doing that. And by never being willing to turn off his camera when something's going on, even when people ask him, that's kind of what he's labeling himself in a sense. So I think there are many other live streamers that feel like, you know, they never cross those lines. And as part of the movement, they're happy to turn their cameras away or point them in another direction if someone's doing something that, you know, isn't something that you would want on film. And Tim doesn't really see himself in that way. He sees himself as kind of above the action in a way. And I think that's kind of where we've run into those problems. But I really don't think it's anything more than Tim Cast and his personal flair in terms of his, you know, a bit of his ego and his notoriety. And even the money that he's been able to raise,
right,
you know, is kind of makes other people feel a little bit...
I mean, putting aside like, that personality stuff, I mean, forget that stuff, because that stuff always happens in the context of any movement. But this notion, I'm curious about this notion as to the role of a live streamer. Is there a place for people who are out there live streaming to not be directly affiliated or in any ways affiliated with the Occupy movement and simply function as a journalist, one who streams the good as well as the bad?
Yeah, no, I think that's fine. I just think that you have to make the distinction between whether you consider yourself, you know, part of the movement or whether you're just covering it objectively. And I think there are plenty of journalists who have been here from the very beginning, you know, people like Ryan Devereaux of The Guardian, Allison Kilkenny, who have very clearly stated that they are journalists and they're covering this and they're not actual participants. But Tim has definitely, you know, called himself or at least hinted that he's part of Occupy Wall Street.
Well, he started with the Other 99. I mean, that was the name of his, you know, that his original stream is. I mean, so that's fairly explicit. So what you're saying is that if you're going to function as a journalist that is not affiliated with the movement, then you've got to explicit about that.
Correct. You know, and while other journalists, I mean, you know, Jesse Meyerson is someone who I think considers himself openly a protester as well as a journalist.
Right.
And so I think that's the sort of distinction that you see here. And Tim's been kind of trying to play it on both sides of that fence.
Interesting. Well, I imagine there'll be more, not necessarily dealing with Tim Pool, but these are questions that I think any movement deals with as they grow. And I appreciate your letting us know. And so when's your next date? When do you have to go see the judge?
They are filing motions now, so we'll be filing motions to dismiss the case, and the district attorney will file their motions to proceed. And the next date is March the 12th, back in court, and hopefully hopefully all will go well.
Jeff, this is what you get for using those nasty First Amendment rights, buddy. I hope you've learned your lesson.
I have indeed, and you know, I'm learning what it's all about to be an American and a journalist and both at the same time.
Well, I appreciate your joining us, Jeff Smith. Don't be a putz on Twitter. Thanks for talking to me.
All right, thanks a lot, Sam. Bye.
Talk to you soon. All right, folks. Now we head to the better half of the show. Oh, and I got news for you. I don't know if the freeloaders are going to get all of that. I don't know. I don't know if they will. No, Matt says no.
I don't think so.
I got a talking to by Nikki the other day. And she's like, you're giving away too much for free. People won't join for membership. And you guys need the members. You need to crack down. See, I mean, you get a notion of what goes on in my household. You get a notion of who the softy is. There's a mile of nose she can roll me. Nikki, no. So we may be instituting some new things very shortly because we need your support, ladies and gentlemen. You can become a member at majority.fm. You can support the show by using, if you buy junk through Amazon. Not saying you should, but I know a lot of you do. Go to majority.fm, click support the show, click on the Amazon link. You need to do this only once. You simply bookmark it every time you buy, whether it's a book or a movie or a computer or a tractor or whatever it is people buy on Amazon. Buy it through our link. You will see absolutely no difference. But we get a little bit of a kickback. Tiny, tiny kickback. And every little bit helps. You can also support the show and do yourself a favor by going to justcoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade. That means no slave labor. Organic. The company's great. The employees are like owners of the company. We're going to get these guys on to explain fair trade so that people really get what the heck this is about. And you use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. That's what we call a win-win-win. Three wins situation. I challenge you to find me another win-win-win situation. I've heard of win-win situations, but not win-win-win. All right, folks, we also got merch, all that. Call into the program, 646-257-3920, or IM me at Majority FM. Back with the better half in a second.